You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. Happy Tuesday afternoon to each and every one of you. My name is Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We start with breaking news. Just this past hour, the Supreme Court has paved the way for the Trump administration to move forward with plans to slash the federal workforce and dismantle numerous federal agencies. The decision could result in tens of thousands of job losses across agencies, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of State, Treasury, the Veterans Administration, and the list goes on. This interim order, which lifted a lower court's ruling that had blocked the mass layoffs, was unsigned and did not include a vote count, which is typical in these emergency shadow docket matters. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote a public and frankly steaming dissent, as she is now known to do. At least there's one voice of reason on the court these days. Of course, I will dive more deeply into her dissent and this news tomorrow, because we have quite a packed show for you today. I'm going to get to some other additional breaking news, but let me tell you what we've got in store for you this afternoon here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is Tuesday, so I'm thrilled, as I always am, to be joined by my good friend and yours, Angela Lang, the Executive Director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities. Welcome back, Angela. Happy belated July 4th to you.
Yeah, happy belated July 4th. It's my first real day back in the office. We had a little bit of a break 4th of July week, so feels like a Monday to me. Moving slow.
Well, and I heard you did some work for Civic Media yesterday as well. We're always so very happy to have you. Also this afternoon, Angela and I will be talking with Stephanie Bloomingdale. She is the Wisconsin president of the AFL-CIO. We're going to talk about the big, brutal bills impacts on labor. And when I say labor, I don't just mean organized labor. And Stephanie and Angela are going to help us understand why, even if you have never been in a union, the way that the brutal bill attacks working people and labor will be important to you. That conversation coming up at 4:30. At the 5 o'clock hour, we'll be joined by Lindsay Owens. She is a consumer advocate expert. Well, what does that mean? She is the executive director of the Economic Think Tank Groundwork Collaborative. So when you've heard all this talk about the big brutal bill and you're like, well, what does that actually mean for my pocketbook? Well, Lindsay's going to help us unpack all that at 5. And at 5:30, Jeff Mandel joins us from Law Forward, because a highly technical but crucially important Wisconsin Supreme Court decision came down today. This is not one that I'm going to suggest you read, because it is about presentment and all kinds of very technical separation of powers issues. But it has one crucially important impact in our state. Jeff is going to help us all understand this. So you're going to want to stay with us throughout the whole entire show. I might even get to the clinic that the Milwaukee Brewers put on yesterday at AmFam Field against the Dodgers. I love to see it. Stayed up for all of that game. And y'all know that I love me some baseball. And we do need some levity these days. So all that coming up for you. But Angela, you and I have not had the opportunity to be together on this program in a hot minute. And a whole heck of a lot has gone down. We're going to get to each and every bit of that, yes. But I wanted to get that there was a little bit of news. We all knew this was happening, but the returning superintendent for the Department of Public Instruction, Dr. Jill Underley, was sworn in officially today for her next term. Again, she won re-election back in April. That ended up being a little bit more of a contested race than many expected, usually a bit of a sleeper. And I just, you know, we've got the state's biennial budget, and there have been a lot of criticisms from folks on the left, both of Governor Evers specifically, but also of other legislative Democrats, specifically some of the leaders like Senator LaTanya Johnson, who was on this program right after the budget deal was announced. criticizing those leaders, as well as Senator Dianne Hesselbein, who was on our show yesterday, basically saying, listen, you didn't get any increase in general school aides. You didn't get the Medicaid expansion. You didn't get postpartum Medicaid expansion. This wasn't good enough. And Angela, given Dr. Underley's swearing in today, I thought I wanted to start with that bit of news to get your take on the biennial budget, because I constantly struggle with Democrats who take a my way or the highway. It's got to be perfect and we got to get everything approached or it's trash. And then I'm going to trash other Dems who realize that, hey, we don't control the state legislature, so we're not going to get everything on our punch list. What was your reaction to the critical improvements in the University of Wisconsin systems, special ed reimbursement rate, absolutely critical, and of course, the big one, the big kahuna, hundreds of millions of dollars in funding that wasn't there before for childcare in the state. What do you think? Good budget? Harm reduction or harm avoiding budget? The best we can do? Or screw you, Governor Evers. What say you, Angela Lang?
Depending on the day,
fair.
There was definitely a screw you, Governor Evers, last week, not gonna lie. I made some anchor phone calls to the office. And you know, I agree with, you know, I know Dan Schaefer has a piece out, and I agree that I do think that this budget could have been a lot better than what we had. I will start by saying I'm not naive to the fact that we are living in Robin Voss's Republican controlled legislature.
So I
think folks, there's a way that you can be critical but also have like a very grounded understanding, like analysis of the landscape that we're in, and still be critical to know that we could have gotten more. I've talked to a lot of teachers and a lot of educators who are not happy. You know, special ed funding, great that there's an increase, but folks have asked for like a 90%, you know, rate. And
right, so that we can get same replacement rate that voucher schools do.
Exactly. And so it's still not even getting to that point.
Here's my question. Do you think those things were possible? Because I was around when the negotiations were going down with Dems and Republicans, and specifically Voss, Lemieux, and others, when it came to the sales tax, which has its pros and cons, and we know them. Sales taxes are regressive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I heard Voss say, if XYZ gets brought up again, these negotiations are over.
Yeah.
Right? And that is a known tactic that Speaker Voss has used for years, and he means it. He has walked away from negotiating tables. So do you think those things were possible? What could have been done to bring them into? Because the thing with negotiations, right, is there is the zone of potential agreement and no one knows exactly what that is.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, understanding it's Robin Voss, right? And you have to go in very clear-eyed and understanding that that is the role in the dynamic. I also feel that a lot of folks didn't feel that the governor really fought for his own budget. You know, my own state senator, Senator Larson, had some pretty scathing remarks about, you know, not seeing, you know, in 15 years, not seeing someone, you know, defend their governor or their own budget, you know, the way that Tony didn't this cycle. So there's been a lot of scathing remarks. And so I do think that we could have gotten more. Would we have gotten all the things that progressives wanted? Absolutely not. And I don't think that we're naive to think so. But one thing that I think we could have gotten that actually made its way to the bill that the governor decided to take out was the closing of Lincoln or of the Green Bay prison.
Yeah.
And that was my biggest, it's my biggest criticism, because it made its way into the budget. And then the governor did a line item veto to veto the deadline of 2029. And that was something that we could have actually gotten. It made its way to the final. But the governor, after saying in our own office in 2018, saying, I want to reduce the prison population by half, now is not even having a deadline and even applying pressure to even close this institution. So that was something that I do think that the governor could have done. And that had nothing to do with Robin Voss. There's Democrats and Republicans on both sides that said that they, especially in the area, want to get this closed. It is a bipartisan effort. And it was the governor himself and his team or whoever, not Robin Voss, that did that line item veto at 1:30 in the morning.
Do you understand what the logic behind that was? Did he just think it can't be done by 29? He doesn't even know if he's going to run for a third term. I don't get it strategically.
So what I don't either, but I will tell you what the governor's office called me, because we tweeted at them and then immediately I got a phone call back. Their logic when I asked them was that they didn't think that the Republicans' plan was sufficient and was even realistic to be able to close by 2029. And I respectfully pushed back of like, well, now you have no plan at all. You thought the Republicans didn't have a plan. You have even less of a plan now of the deadline. But it's my understanding that that $15 million that was allocated is still there. I'm waiting to get answers back of what that is going to be used for, especially now that there's no pressure and there's no, it doesn't seem like there's a real will to close the Green Bay prison. And just for folks that don't know, the Green Bay prison has had a long list of, I would just say flat out human rights violations. It is terrible. If you just Google the Green Bay prison, you will see lots of reports that come out, especially in the last year or so. And the governor said, you know, he's committed to closing it, but he's not really doing anything, especially line item vetoing that that deadline, especially when it made its way through Robin Voss's process. And I'm going to call it his process. It made its way to, you know, his desk, and the governor himself vetoed it.
We could spend, and maybe we should do this, Angela, and I know my senior producer, Jamie, is listening. Angela and I, would you be interested in having a long discussion with me about institutionalization and the prison problem? Because
absolutely,
it has become an industry that is extraordinarily self-perpetuating. It defends itself. It's extremely sticky. The idea that a sitting Democratic governor who's pledged to reduce the prison population, in other words, release from custody those who have low likelihood of recidivism, who are nonviolent offenders, these are largely drug offenses, and get people treatment and into different pathways other than the incarceration cycle. I think that would be an incredibly important conversation because, you know, the third rail in politics is nobody runs soft on crime, but that is such a stupid idea because that's not what it is about. It's about how do you legitimately create safer communities and understanding that the threat of prison in many, many circumstances is zero deterrence for what the sort of crime that we see that is disruptive in our communities. Folks, we're going to return with Angela. We're going to touch upon what is potentially a looming transit strike in the city of Milwaukee and the potential cascading consequences across our state. Even if you think it might not matter to you, let me assure you it does. Angela and I discuss more when we return right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're rejoining us. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm joined as a co-host this first hour by Angela Lang. She's the executive director of Black Leaders Organizing Communities, or BLOC. She joins me every Tuesday for this first half hour. And Angela, I wanted to talk about this. It seems that every time they're trying to renegotiate the Milwaukee County Transit System bus driver's contract, that we get within seemingly minutes of a strike. And there was news that came out approximately, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago, just before the holiday, that an unknown budget deficit was looming for MCTS this year, somewhere north of $10 million. Mm-hmm. And so what the transit union is asking for is basically to put public safety officers, query who that is, how they're trained, how that works, onto buses, not all buses, certain buses. They claim buses that have high rates of fare evasion. We may get into that a little bit. So they're asking for raises as well as these safety officers on the buses. And I will not say that bus drivers don't face a panoply of challenges in doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. But the economic realities of that transit system are dire. This is not a problem that is one union contract solvable. Operating costs, the costs of buses themselves, of labor, of all kinds of different equipment, even the maintenance equipment itself, have skyrocketed. Our transit system in the Milwaukee area is struggling. How do you feel about this particular moment? Because having worked at the county, I understand these budget constraints, right? We're getting pinched from all sides. Sure. As someone who believes in the dignity of organized labor, I understand what they're asking too. I have concerns about some of the safety officer ideas for a whole panoply of reasons, but it really seems like it's rock and hard place. How do they break through this seemingly unbridgeable gulf?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be rough. And I say this as someone who, like, grew up on the bus system. I took the bus to school in high school, right?
Yep.
I didn't get my license until 2013 because I had to for my job, right? So, like, I grew up on the bus system. I also say this as a person who's, like, first job out of college was for a labor union, right? And I think... we've been here before. You know, I remember several years ago, there was another, you know, like strike, and it was, you know, there are times it's around the 4th of July, or it's around Summerfest, which, you know, from a strategic standpoint, that's where you apply the pressure, right? Yep. That's where you have some leverage in contract negotiations. And I will always be on the side of labor and of unions. But I will say it's going to be a tricky scenario for them to navigate with this unexpected deficit that was revealed, like you said. Yep. I think it's one thing to want to do right and, you know, be like a greedy boss. It's another to be like, well, I want to do right, but like, I literally don't have the funds. And so I'm curious to see, you know, like, does the county board have to get involved? The you know, the county budget process is going to happen in the fall. Is this also like a state legislature issue of trying to get increased funding from the state? Whatever it is, I don't envy folks that have to negotiate that contract. But, you know, I'm supportive of all the drivers that many of which who kind of raised me and kind of looked out for me when I was that, you know, 13-year-old riding on the bus by myself. And yeah, I think it's going to be very difficult. And I think this is what we talk about, is when you have these budget shortfalls, not only does it impact the worker, it also has a ripple effect. Folks getting to and from work where, you know, they can't afford to get a lift all the time. All of these things, it's going to have a ripple effect. And everyone involved should do the best that they can to make sure that they're honoring as much as possible the union wishes.
Well, this is with our next guest coming up. This was so timely, right, to talk with Stephanie Bloomingdale. She's coming up at the bottom of the hour, the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. I don't know what the solution for MCTS is. I don't. And I worked at the county for nearly 8 years. Mm-hmm. It is always these same issues. One of the things that people should know is bus drivers are instructed not to deny ridership to someone who refused to pay a fare, because that's their job is not fare enforcement. Mm-hmm. And the idea of public safety officers on the buses brings up a whole panoply of questions about who is being enforced by what standards and all of the potential biases that come with that. And yet, I know that many drivers have been in unsafe situations.
Yeah.
The reality is that the entire economy of the state of Wisconsin needs a transit system in the city of Milwaukee. And what I do know is that when Scott Walker became governor, the idea of mass transit of any kind was under attack. And that does not serve any community well. And the reason that I say the entire economy of Wisconsin needs MCTS is that the folks that rely on MCTS to get to school, to get to work, to do their jobs and live their lives are an absolutely critical part of our state's economy. These are the folks that keep things moving in Milwaukee. This is a ton of the UWM students, right? All of these people are essential. This is a problem that will need to be solved. I don't see a simple pathway forward. No. We're going to come back with Angela Lang and Stephanie Bloomingdale, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, to talk about how the big, brutal bill is coming for Wisconsin's middle class, because even if you've never been in a union, trust me, the brutal bill is coming for you. Stay tuned, folks. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got my guest co-host with me this afternoon. Her name is Angela Lang of Black Leaders Organizing Communities. And on behalf of Angela and I, we are thrilled to welcome Stephanie Bloomingdale. She is the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. And I will say this with reverential respect and reverential respect and humility, perhaps, that you are the first female president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. And so as a woman who has worked my entire life, thank you not only for what you do to represent labor, but women in labor and women in labor unions. Thank you, Stephanie, for being here.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Maggie, for inviting me to be here with you today for the show. And also, it's so great to see Angela Lang. I've known Angela for a very long time, so it's really nice to be here for the first time on your show. And I know you have a lot of big topics, so hopefully I won't screw it up too much here.
That's not possible, Stephanie.
We're breezy over here.
Yeah, we're very breezy. You just talk about what you know and what you're passionate about, and we'll be peachy keen. Let's get right into it. The Big Brutal Bill is basically an all-out assault on working Americans. But what I think, as we've watched union membership rates decline since Republicans really launched an all-out attack on organized labor back starting with Richard Nixon, you know, folks don't always understand that even if you are not yourself in a labor union, unions serve an absolutely critical function in so many ways about the labor marketplace. And where unions have a strong presence and where membership on a per capita basis is higher, you see higher hourly wages, you see greater real wage increases, you see more benefits that actually meet the needs of working families. Put that together for folks. This is just sort of a baseline center. Why does organized labor benefit everybody who actually works for a paycheck and not just those in the union?
Well, Maggie, that's a really great place to start, because it really, by setting up this conversation in this way, we're thinking about where do workers derive their power and their power in our economy. And, you know, we can go way back in history, but the general idea is that when people come together with their coworkers to have a voice in the workplace, to negotiate a contract, to increase wages and benefits and put those in a contract, which means that they can be guaranteed those benefits, those workers do better. And by having more workers in unions, not only those workers who are organized into those contracts or into those areas do better for themselves, it also creates a ripple effect throughout the entire economy. Now, when you go back to the kind of benefits that we, some people, not us, but take for granted, like the 40-hour work week, or like having, you know, I mean, we have a very terrible minimum wage, but there is a minimum wage.
It exists, yes.
It exists. And if they could go below that, believe me, they would. And also, any of the kind of the OSHA laws we have, the worker safety laws, the protections for our kids in the workplace. These kind of protections were not given to us by politicians. They were not handed to us by corporate bosses. These were things that that were fought for by working men and women throughout this country. And so it's really important to understand where that came from and then the struggle that has existed, you know, since the beginning of time between the owners of the capital or the business and those of us who work to make their product. So what we want is in organized laborers, we don't want to have all of that, but we want a fair share. We want a fair share of that profit to be able to take care of ourselves and our families and our communities. And when we have more people in labor unions, and you've seen that in Wisconsin as well, that we had, you know, a good amount of unionization, especially in manufacturing. And we also had it in the public sector, and I'm sure we'll get into that more. But when there are attacks on labor, this reduces all of our ability to have good wages and working conditions and benefits.
Folks, that's Stephanie Bloomingdale, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, joining Angela and I for this half hour. Stephanie, I'm an economist, and it always sort of defied just baseline logic to me that folks did not understand, or that some folks claim to not understand, that the individual worker does not stand in a position of bargaining power parity with the business owner, and that unions, by joining together like a mutual fund for working conditions, if you will, that is the way that workers can attempt to stand on some level of bargaining power, less disparity there. It's not quite at parity either, but less disparity. And that critically, if you believe and you say you believe in capitalism, guess what? Capitalism relies on actual free choice, which necessitates a level playing field, that people can actually come together and bargain, not that a business owner can effectively extort, abuse, and then discard labor at will. So it's always been a bit of and I know this is fairly high level, Stephanie, but I just didn't understand that. Isn't it totally obvious for any of us that have worked where we weren't unionized that often our interactions with our bosses are take it or leave it propositions? And we have all felt that bargaining power disparity if we are people who have worked for paychecks at any point in time in our lives. And I don't care how fancy the job is. I worked at some of the largest law firms in the world. There was not a 40-hour work week, and I've seen some of the most abusive behaviors that I think people can come up with in those places. So this goes all across the working spectrum. What do you say to people that say unions and successful business can't coexist at the same time? That if a business is quote unquote forced to have unionized workforce, well, there goes the business.
Well, I think that one of the points that you made here, which were there's so many things to talk about here, but that if you really want a free market, and capitalism is supposed to exist in a free market, then they shouldn't be artificially reducing the free will, the free power of working people. And every time they have an anti-union law or an anti-union law firm that comes in to dissuade people from making that own free choice, they are no longer acting in a free market sensibility. So in terms of people, when they say to them, well, you can do this without your coworkers, well, really what they're saying is that they want to be able to negotiate with that individual worker on their own. And we know that when workers come together, they have more power, and we have an understanding of what everyone else is making for the job. And we are raising sometimes jobs that would be considered not great jobs. We in the union movement, what our job is to make them good jobs, which means to have them have a decent wage for family supporting wage, make sure that they have benefits, and make sure that it's safe on the job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when anybody says, oh, well, those jobs are no good, the way to make a, a job that's not currently great is to organize and make those good jobs. Because all of us, anybody who works deserves dignity and respect on the job.
Absolutely. So I want to go back to this big, brutal bill, because I refuse to call it a big, beautiful bill, right? It is an attack on workers. It is an attack on so many different things. And, you know, I think about my time when I was over at SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, and like how folks were just like not trying to hear anything. Folks were frustrated. I'm very curious of what like union membership is feeling right now, especially acknowledging that there are some union members that may have voted for Trump. Like, are folks internalizing what this could actually mean for them, their loved ones, their families, their workplaces?
Their
what are
jobs.
Folks feeling? Yeah.
Their jobs. Well, I mean, I think that when we're looking at this, what are you calling it, Angela? A big, brutal bill?
Yep. Big, brutal bill.
Okay. Big, brutal bill. That is a good word to use for it, because if you really look at this bill, it gives so much to the ultra wealthy, so yeah. much to the ultra wealthy, and reduces the benefit for working people. So if you add it all up, if you are not in the top 20%, if you're not in the top 10%, if you're not in the top 1%, you are not, overall, you are not getting a benefit out of this bill. Now, there are some things that are put in there that I was talking with Maggie before. There is a no tax on overtime, and there's no tax on tips. Now, I'm not giving out tax advice, so you know, please don't refer to me when you're filling out your taxes. But when I really started digging into this, it's not as easy as it sounds, and it's not as good as it sounds, because a lot of our tipped workers are not paying that higher level of taxes
right.
in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it's something that sounds really great. And if you are a tipped worker, okay, you know, you're going to be able to fill that out, and you're going to have to do that when you fill out your taxes. But compare that to the drastic cuts in our food and nutrition programs. Compare that to the drastic cuts in Medicaid. This is just very, very overwhelming for people. And I don't really think that it's necessarily hit everyone yet, because when I'm researching this, in terms of if somebody's going to be eligible for these programs, they have to now register for those programs at, like, what is it, every 6 months. And it used to be at a longer period of time. So this is not only going to add to the burden of the people that need this assistance, but it's also it's going to require the state and the county to do a lot more to be able to figure out the eligibility requirements. So overall, there are some really, really big gifts in here for the ultra wealthy.
Yeah. When I heard about, oh, we're going to do no tax on tips and no tax on overtime, my immediate thought was, as the wealthiest among us that need nothing more dine at the feast of all feasts, don't be fooled by the table scraps. You deserve better. We're going to come back with Stephanie Bloomingdale, the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, and my guest co-host for this hour, Angela Lang, executive director of Block. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Up next, what about the union worker that votes for Trump? How do we get through? We discuss next.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got my co-host this hour, Angela Lang. She's the executive director of Block. And we are joined this half hour by Stephanie Bloomingdale, the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. Thanks for sticking around, Stephanie. Really appreciate it. One thing that I hear people, again, in all kinds of different jobs, all across the income spectrum, but people who work for paychecks, who aren't just, you know,
enjoying the tax breaks that a dollar created from wealth get in this country. But people who actually work for a living are concerned about is artificial intelligence, especially general artificial intelligence, and the prospect that jobs may be eliminated in coming years. It was beyond comprehension to me that numerous MAGAs that voted in the House for the first version of the budget reconciliation bill went, oh, I didn't realize that Congress was giving away its legislative authority for a decade to look into or regulate in any way, shape, or form artificial intelligence. What happened to the artificial intelligence preemption, and why does it matter so much to working people in this country?
Well, thank you. And, you know, there's so many bad things in this big, brutal bill that it would probably take a couple of days to go through all of them, and massive giveaways to the ultra wealthy amongst us. But one of the items that came through in the House version was an all out preemption of any states making any regulations on AI for an entire 10 years. And that would also reverse any regulations that had already been enacted. Mm. So this was really alarming to us. You know, at the AFL-CIO and Wisconsin AFL-CIO and the unions all across the country, we're very concerned about how AI is going to impact our work, how it's going to impact our economy. And we are concerned about our data. We are concerned about our security. We are concerned about how it affects our kids. And to have them and they pass this in the middle of the night, of course.
Of course.
And it for a whole 10 years that all the biggest tech companies said, whoa, 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 no states, you can't do anything. And we need that because we need it for competition. But we quickly sounded the alarm on this and talked with both Republicans and Democrats in our state legislature, because they're the ones that would be their rights are being would have been mm-hmm. taken away. And so we did get a lot of activity around that and really tried to make sure that we educated our members on this and the general public, because a lot of people are kind of confused or maybe not right there to talk about AI. They're like, oh, well, I don't know. It's that thing that, you know, it's confusing to people. And we, I believe, need to go that extra mile to break it down and to make sure that it is something that helps working people and not destroys us. So we're happy that it got taken out. We're happy it got taken out in the Senate. It got completely stripped. They tried to do a last minute thing where
they did.
Oh, do it for 5 years and let's tie it to broadband because it couldn't get through the bird rule, the bird bath.
Yes.
So it couldn't make it through. So they changed it up. But finally, it is one bright spot in the bill that was taken out and removed completely.
Folks, if you don't know what the birdbath is, don't worry. What it is this hyper-technical thing that happens in the Senate, where the Senate's parliamentarian reviews a budget reconciliation bill to ensure that what is actually in the reconciliation is budget-related, as opposed to crafting standalone brand new policy and just shoving it into what should look like and actually quack like a budget bill. Pardon my mixed metaphors here, everybody. And so the bird bath is when it's not a duck, it gets washed out in the bird bath. And that's what happened to this AI state preemption. Absolutely critical. It reminds me, Stephanie, that when we look at technological change, we should be looking at how do we help and stand shoulder to shoulder with working people as regular working families in the United States have to survive and hopefully thrive as this technology evolves more and more rapidly. Where does the AFL-CIO stand in advocating for workers in terms of retraining or even relocation, as we see, again, all of these technological advancements accelerating in these next few years?
Well, we're definitely taking a look at all of these things. And Education is really important on this. And this idea that we have control about where this is going. We don't have to be just bystanders and say, well, it's tech, so it's going to do what tech does. Right. Human beings create AI, and we can determine what AI is used for. And I would contend, and we would contend, that it should be used to help working people and not hurt us.
So important. And the data security for folks. Angela, you're going to have the last word this hour.
Yeah. And I just want to say thank you, Stephanie, for all the work that you're doing, because especially right now in this administration, but also since the Walker era, right? Yes. Wisconsin has been beaten down and the labor movement just keeps coming back and is incredibly strong. And I think that there's a moment where there's an opportunity to continue to do education to members and really bring people together in a way that we never really have before. So I just want to say thank you for this conversation and thank you for your work.
Thank you to Angela Lang and Stephanie Bloomingdale. And I offer to you this, folks. When you hear Republicans talk about bootstraps, ask yourself this. If you're willing to work 40 hard hours of work, maybe even 50, shouldn't you be able to live on that in dignity without fear? Because that's the social contract I signed up for, didn't you? The Maggie Dawn Show continues on the other side. News, weather, and sports are next. Don't go anywhere. We got another great guest coming up with next. It's Lindsay Owens, expert consumer advocate. Thank you.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.